When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hi everyone, welcome to another episode of Hidden Histories. Today I spoke to David Petz. So David and I talk all about the archaeology of the holy island of Lindisfarne in Northumbria, which some of you might be familiar with or have even maybe visited. I haven't visited Lindisfarne, but I have always wanted to, as I'm personally fascinated by its spiritual past and the atmosphere that still pervades the island today. David talks about the importance of the sea and the tide to the island, and also the famous figures who live there, like St Cuthbert and Bede, but also importantly how archaeology can inform us in a different way about the past, in contrast to the way historians look at sources. This was a great podcast and I really enjoyed recording it, so I hope that you also enjoy it. David Petz, welcome to Hidden Histories. It's such a pleasure to have you on the podcast to talk about all of your research and your very practical skills as an archaeologist as well. And we're going to talk about the holy island of Lindisfarne, which, as I was just saying a minute ago to you, is just one of my ultimate destinations in England. I can't believe I've not been. So can you tell me, where is Lindisfarne and why is it considered such an important place even today?
Absolutely. Well, Lindisfarne, it's a small tidal island and it's off the northeast coast of Northumberland. And it's about 10, 15 miles south of the Scottish border, though in the Anglo-Saxon period, that meant absolutely nothing. There was no Anglo-Scottish border. It owes its importance because it was one of the most substantial, one of the most wealthy, one of the most influential early medieval monastic sites in Britain. And it sits on a kind of the edge of the world of the early medieval English, and it has links with them, but also it has connections with the Picts, it has connections with the Scots, it has connections with Ireland. So it's on a kind of cultural boundary, and it channeled all those influences through most of the early medieval period.
Why do you think that it was chosen as such an important monastic site in its implementation?
Yeah, well, I think one of the most important things about Lindisfarne is its islandness, the fact that it's a tidal island. It was founded by King Oswald, who'd been in exile in Scotland. He had probably converted to Christianity either at the island monastery of Iona or was converted by monks from Iona. So when he comes back to take over the reins of power in Northumbria, it's natural that I think that he would look for a similar kind of site. Iona was a massively influential monastery on the Atlantic coast. And I think he was looking to replicate that for his new kingdom in Northumbria.
Yeah. So it's sort of, because I was going to ask, is it modelled on another holy site? So Iona being an earlier site in Scotland, I think, is it the west coast of Scotland?
Yes, it's west coast of Scotland. Yeah. So it's just off Mull. Yeah. I mean, the thing with monasteries is they're modelled on lots of things. So they something like Lindisfarne would have been kind of modelled on Iona in the sense that it was copying Iona, but it's a kind of recursive process. So Iona itself, in its own way, is actually modelled on things like Jerusalem, the way they've tried to lay it out. They're modelling it on their understanding of what the original holy places were. So we have this kind of chain of associations with Lindisfarne referring to Iona, which refers to Jerusalem. It's kind of networks and kind of threads of associations. Really interesting.
Iona is such a special place. I have been there and it's beautiful. And you do get a sense of it feeling incredibly spiritual and very special, very protected. Do you think that this idea of seclusion and protection is the reason why islands were particularly popular to establish monasteries?
I think there's a tension with island locations. Certainly in the Bible, there is the idea that the ocean was particularly the route, the Atlantic Ocean rather than the Mediterranean, was on the edge of the world. It was on the kind of, for the early Christians, on the literal and metaphorical edge of things. So we have this idea that islands are remote places where you're exposed to something beyond civilization. But I think we need to be careful, because we can overdo that. Because equally, whether you are an early medieval monk in the Atlantic world or in the North Sea world, sea lanes and the coasts, these are major communication routes. So in some ways, yes, they're kind of keying into the idea of isolation. But at the same time, they're quite important landmarks. They're places where boats would have gone past all the time. Lindisfarne is 3 or 4 miles as a crow flies, or seagull flies, from Bamborough, which is a really important Anglo-Saxon royal palace. So it's this kind of ostentatious isolation. They're being isolated, but they're doing it in really obvious places where people can see it. So it's this kind of strange kind of a halfway house of being a bit isolated, but quite self-conscious about it.
Yeah. And I mean, do you think that made these monastic sites quite vulnerable? Or do you think that it was there was more benefit rather than their vulnerability? Because I know that there were Viking attacks on Iona fairly regularly, and there were later in Lindisfarne. But I mean, was that a case of few and far between, and actually the benefits far outweighed the negatives?
Well, it's about, Lindisfarne's founded in 635, and it's about a good 150 years before the Vikings start getting there. The advantage of being on the coastal location like that is that you have good communication routes. You can get, you can travel by boat much more quickly than you can on foot. So if you're a monk in Iona, a monk in Lindisfarne, if you want to get up to the north of Northumbria or into Scotland, you take a boat. If you want to go down south to East Anglia or the continent, you take a boat. So you've got those fantastic communication routes. Also, the 7th century is a period when we're getting increasing international exchange, particularly in the North Sea. So they're kind of plugging in to those kind of routes of trade, economy, and also movement of ideas as well. So I think being on those coastal locations is pretty important.
Okay. So a lot of your research has gone into the tides and the impact of the tides on Lindisfarne. Why did the tides have an important part to play? I mean, was this factored into the development of the monastery?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think the first thing to, as I've mentioned, Lindisfarne is a tidal island. So when the tide comes in, you can't get off it. And when the tide goes out, you can walk across the sand. So immediately for any Christian monks, that idea of a sea parting and coming together again, immediately that's linked to the idea of the parting of the Red Sea. It's this lovely kind of rhyming landscape. It rhymes with the Bible. It gives people that sense of the divine in action. And when you look at the early written sources, the saints' lives written at the time, they're very conscious of the sea as a channel through which God's power could be made manifest. So obviously, if you go to the Gospels themselves, you have the idea of Jesus on the Sea of Galilee and him calming storms. But once you get into the Anglo-Saxon world, we see the sea is something which brings resources. Cuthbert has wood brought to him on the Farne Islands to help build his hermitage. Food washes up on the beaches, so Cuthbert's able to find dolphin meat when he's up in Scotland. It's left there on the strand. And tidal zones, these lovely multifaceted sites. They're not quite sea, they're not quite land. So they get freighted with all sorts of interesting kind of symbolic connotations quite quickly.
They're also they're connected to the lunar activity. And so do you think there was an element of kind of there's cosmic Christianity sort of amalgamation? Do you think that has something to do with this as well?
Well, this is a period when the monks, early Christianity is very exercised with knowing when things happen. Because obviously, Christianity, you've got a series of seasonal feast days, so things like Easter. And obviously, one of the great debates between different elements of the early Christian church was precisely when you celebrate Easter. And a lot of it is about, they're very interested in monitoring the solar processes, lunar processes. They're really interested in actually trying to engage with a lot of these natural processes. So somebody like Bede, who's based at a monastery, you know, about kind of 30, 40 miles south, he is clearly writing about how to calculate time, how to calculate tides. It's part of their life world. And again, just physically getting on and off the island, you need to know when the tides are, otherwise you're stuck. So there's a lot of interest in knowing how the tides work. As you get further south into East Anglia, again, tidal landscapes, tides go a long way inland. Get over onto the North Sea, the Netherlands before all the land reclamation. The North Sea is fringed by lands which are remade by tides every day. So they get incredibly exercised about knowing precisely when they are.
So there was a very much a human understanding and interaction with tidal activity and the way that the sea and the water moved around the landscape during this period in a way that is probably, we probably don't really give credit to now. Would you say that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, they're really interested in actually working out how it works. And what's interesting is when you see Bede writing about it, he's very aware that the tide comes in at different places along the coast at different times. So he's clearly got a network of informants. He's doing this by observation as well as it's not an abstract exercise in mental arithmetic. He's actually looking at the nature itself, noticing when it comes in at different times. It's kind of early science, really. And they're doing this very kind of objective analysis of the tides. At precisely the same time, they're also writing about the tides as these miraculous agents of God. So they're it's a complex, they've got a complex understanding of what's going on.
I love Bede. I was going to ask you about him. There's so much that we know and we take from this period because of Bede. I mean, what can we learn from him about Lindisfarne and its relationship with the sea? Is he quite lyrical in his descriptions, or is he quite observational?
Bede's great piece of work is obviously the Ecclesiastical History, and when he starts that in the preface, he talks about how Britain is provided with all these maritime resources. He talks about all the fish and the other creatures that abound in the sea. So he's very interested in, very aware of the wealth of the sea. And when he talks about Lindisfarne, he's talking about lots of other stuff as well. But he describes it. He talks about the tidal presences, and then he goes on to write two biographies of two lives of Saint Cuthbert, who is one of the key figures. And there, that's where he indulges himself much more, talking about particularly these miracles associated with Cuthbert. He doesn't give us much physical description of the monastery. You know, he mentions one or two things in passing. So we know there's a cemetery for the monks. We know there's a watchtower which looks out to sea. We know there's some churches. But he doesn't describe it much. He's more interested in that sense of what people are doing. He's not a great describer of places.
St. Cuthbert is very famous. I mean, I probably argue that most people have heard of St. Cuthbert. What can the archaeology of the island tell us about Cuthbert and his experiences and his importance on the island as well?
Well, Cuthbert's a really important figure because normally with an early medieval monastery, the key saint would be the saint who founded it. And in the case of Lindisfarne, that's Saint Aidan. But with Lindisfarne is the church in Northumbria went through this great process of internal debate about 30 years after the monastery was founded. And rather than staying with the Irish Ionian tradition, the Northumbrian church kind of pivoted and aligned itself more with the kind of Roman and Frankish tradition of Christianity. Aidan was associated with the wrong kind of Christianity. When Cuthbert becomes abbot, he is really the clean skin. So he becomes the key culted figure on the island. And it's not so much what Cuthbert does when he's alive, but the best thing he does for Lindisfarne is he dies, because that death gives them the saint they need, the new saint. So we see the creation of the cult of Cuthbert, and that's done in various ways. It's done, there's not much paperwork to becoming an Anglo-Saxon saint. So it's done by kind of, it's the usual thing. They dig him up after 10 years and he's miraculously preserved, probably because he's been embalmed heavily. But they they decide he's a saint by acclamation. So they raise the body up out of the grave. They lift it above the ground, put it in a shrine. And that's really what marks the beginning of the cult of Cuthbert. And we see a series of things associated with that. We see replanning. The monastery is kind of reorganised. So we see churches laid out in a way that looks more Frankish, or more Southern Anglo-Saxon. We see the creation of things like the Lindisfarne Gospel, which seems to be part of that cult making of Cuthbert. But also Cuthbert really brings in the pilgrims. He's a kind of cash cow for the monastery. So they're coming in, they're bringing in kind of gold and donations, but also land is given to the monastery as well. So this really leads to Lindisfarne becoming a massive landholder and a massive political entity as much as a religious entity. So Cuthbert's absolutely a key figure in this period.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Why do you think hermitage and being a hermit, as because Cuthbert was a hermit for a time on the island, why do you think that was important to Lindisfarne and indeed, you know, other monastic sites? I mean, can you look to the archaeology to give any understanding of that way of life?
I think one of the key things with these hermits is they have this dual role of people who are seeking isolation, but also when you actually look at the sources, and with hermits more generally in early Christianity, they're also often seen as key figures in dealing with debates and arguments and disputes. Because they have withdrawn from the world, they are seen as people who can be legislators and make difficult decisions. So we know that Cuthbert, he goes off to the Farne Islands, which is another set of rocks even further out from Lindisfarne, but he gets annoyed by the number of people coming to visit him, so he actually alters his cell so he can't be seen. So we've got this idea again, this tension in the island location. So they're trying to go off to the islands, they're trying to seek isolation, but at the same time people still keep on visiting them, people still keep coming to look at them. And it's a reminder that, you know, people are scooting around these seas aren't that. They're not barriers. Seas are routeways to communication. And almost every island along the North Sea coast has got a hermit or a monastery associated with it. Kind of all the way down well into, you know, virtually the English Channel, you know. So we have this kind of landscape planted with hermits all the way down.
Yeah, it was like there was a real trend for it, wasn't there, for quite a while. So as an archaeologist, obviously your identification of historical evidence is somewhat different to a historian. What is it? What's the sort of what is the practice of an archaeologist, and how would you work on a site like Lindisfarne to be able to answer questions about the monk's life on this island?
Well, I think for archaeology, for me, one of the big things is what we're looking at. We're looking at what was actually done. if we look at the historical sources, we can see what people said was done. We can see how people describe things, and people sometimes creative with what they describe. Sometimes they omit things. What I'm interested in is my bigger work on early religion is I'm interested in that tension between the ideal and what actually happened, what actually how religions are practiced. So that's the kind of thing we're interested in when we're looking at early monastic sites. We can look at things, we can look at evidence for how people were buried, we can look at evidence for how the monasteries were laid out. Because, you know, as I said, these are ideologically freighted places. They are laying themselves out to allude to other monasteries, to allude to holy places. And one of the things that the archaeological work on Lindisfarne has done with our work and other work, we're starting to see the emergence of a kind of symbolic landscape. People were moving around this landscape. There are multiple churches. There would have been processions. There would have been kind of liturgy moving around these sites. We can pick up the sculpture associated with the graves. So we're seeing actually, you know, they can talk about burying people, but we don't really know what that actually looks like. But we can see that with archaeology. We can see attitudes to, for example, one of the things we find with our graves is quite a lot of our graves have been associated with these piles of quartz pebbles, these lovely translucent white pebbles. And that is something which is not mentioned in any of the documentary sources, but we pick it up as a very distinct tradition in kind of northern British and Irish Christianity. So we've got a distinctive burial rite, which is only seen through the archaeology. But also it's something, the use of these quartz pebbles, that goes back into antiquity, into the pre-Christian periods. So arguably we're potentially picking up an element of the funerary rites, which has pagan in the broader sense, has pre-Christian origins, but is reworked and retooled, as it were, as a technology associated with Christian burials. So we're seeing how Christianity, although it's an imported religion and bringing stuff in, is also grasping at local traditions and pre-existing practices. Basically, I mean, it's this idea that we have a religion, Christianity, which is brought in, it's an external religion, it's coming from the East Mediterranean, the Near East, but it's being reworked in locally in Northern Britain, drawing on traditions and resources and imagery that are connected to a pre-Christian past. So we'd never pick that up through the documentary sources. So this is what I mean about the idea of looking at religion as practice, is actually what people actually did on and in the ground.
That's what I find amazing about archaeology, because I think it really is, when you're looking at history, it's probably one of the only sources that you can go, okay, well, this is really objective fact rather than a biased interpretation of the way things were. So you can, as you say, you can see how things were literally laid out, how burials were literally practiced, which is quite remarkable, I find, with archaeology. I mean, how much do you think that conflicts or is informed by the surviving sources? For example, we were talking about Bede earlier.
Yeah, there's always, working in an historical period for archaeology, we're always at this tension. We're playing off the archaeology against the texts. But equally, you know, historians, they play off different types of texts against each other, looking for those dissonances. And we play off different elements of archaeology. So they're all different evidential sources. And we're always constantly kind of triangulating, looking for similarities, looking for differences. And it's not the case of that the history trumps the archaeology or vice versa. But what's interesting is actually those discourses where they don't quite mesh. And I think it's where you got those contradictions. That's where a kind of holistic approach to the past, drawing on the documents and the archaeology, that's where it works the best. It's boring if everything agrees. It's much more interesting where you've got that tension. Yeah.
Yeah, it's like a jigsaw puzzle, and just there's occasionally the bits that just aren't fitting or just don't connect. So if somebody were, because obviously we're recording this in a lockdown, if somebody were to visit Lindisfarne, as I think following coming out of lockdowns, I think people are going to be looking to go and visit more sites and more places within the United Kingdom, within their vicinity. What would people expect to see? What is the experience of going to Lindisfarne like today? How do you think it might be similar to the experience of the monks on the island in the the 10th century?
Well, 7th to 10th century, yeah. I mean, it's strange because Lindisfarne now, Holy Island now, is very touristy. There's a huge number of tourists coming in. So on a busy bank holiday afternoon, any sense of isolation, certainly in the village, is gone. Though if you get out onto the north side of the island, you can still have that sense of being a bit more isolated. But those are still people coming in on a pilgrimage in their own kind of way. So we have people who come to the island for the birds, for the wildlife. It's at the end of a long distance footpath. So again, there's that sense of completion. And that's the interesting thing about pilgrimage sites, is there's much about the journey as the end point. So when you come to the island, obviously it's a very different experience. And one of the problems with early medieval sites is there's nothing standing, which is still connected to the early monastery. There's a later monastic ruins, but they're kind of, that's Norman and later. That being said, if you're on the island, if you can get there when the tide's in the evening, when there's far less people there, and it still doesn't take a huge mental leap to get a sense of what that must have been like. You can look across. It's a really interesting landscape, not just the island itself, but the views. As I said, you can see across to the great site at Bamborough, big medieval castle, but a big Anglo-Saxon centre. So you can see across the sea to there very easily. You see across to the Farne Islands, where Cuthbert spent time as a pilgrim. As you look onto the mainland, most of the land you can see would have been land owned by the monks. They had huge amounts of land. You can see, just about peeking over the hills in the distance, the top of Yeavering Bell, can mark very closely another big Anglo-Saxon palace site which stood at its foot. So you can kind of mentally reconstruct the geography. So you get that kind of sense of mapping what the monastery is like. But also in the evenings, it's quiet. You've got the birds, you've got the seals. Always you can hear the seals all the time. And the kind of the sense of a soundscape, and even the smells of the seaweed and things as the tide comes in and out. You can really get a sense of what it must have been like to be on the monastery. I'm sure there would have been other noises and other smells with the monastery, but which we can't capture. But it's a special place still, absolutely.
Yeah. So it's still an incredible experience to be able to be on this island. You can get a sense of the atmosphere that these monks would have felt, and also I suppose you get a sense of this landscape archaeology, because you're looking out and you're seeing all of the different points of interest that would have existed, you know, during the time of Cuthbert. David, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. That was fascinating, and you've informed me. And now I feel like I can go to Lindisfarne feeling like I know a lot more about
it. No, absolute pleasure.
Is there anywhere else that you would recommend people look to find a little bit more out about this period and the idea of island-dwelling monasteries and monks?
Oh, let's think. I mean, I'd point people to our Lindisfarne website for the project. I think the best thing is just to go and visit some of these coastal sites. I mean, places like Tynemouth, Bradwell-on-Sea down in Essex is an amazing site. Again, early standing church, much more remote, much quieter than Lindisfarne.
Yeah. And I would say, you know, we're going to be all looking for things to do in the summer that are outdoors, but also, you know, within the UK. So I think that it's really, I really hope that some of these places, these sites are going to get some more attention, because there are actually quite a few surviving Anglo-Saxon settlements and religious sites, aren't there? So I think that it would be wonderful to be able to reinvigorate them a little bit for the public consciousness.
Absolutely. Fingers crossed.
Super. Thank you, David. And love to have you back on the podcast another time.